and welcome back to the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. I am thrilled that you are with me again this week. I'm your host, Arthur Arkish, and it's been a few since we have chatted, so thanks for coming back and being patient with us while we get a new recording up. We've kind of waited for the dust to settle, I guess, a little bit, almost a week into the new league year, and it's been a whirlwind for sure, but a lot of the big signings have now occurred, and we're in full-on analysis mode at ProFootballWeekly.com. I hope you've been following along with our coverage over there. We've got a top 100 free agency tracker with a ton of analysis, and I've been writing columns and reacting as I see fit to some of the big news. So make sure you've got it locked into ProFootballWeekly.com, and make sure, if you haven't already, that you are subscribed to the Pro Football Weekly podcast over at iTunes. We'd love it if while you're over there, you give us a rating and leave a comment. Let us know what we can do better. Again, it's a great pleasure to be with you today, and it's also going to be a great pleasure to bring on a wonderful guest here in just a couple minutes, Joel Corey from CBS Sports. You guys know Joel's work not only from CBS but National Football Post, and he's an awesome follow on Twitter for all your salary cap needs, a former sports agent who kind of breaks down some of the deals and the trends throughout the NFL, you know, free agency and signing periods as well as anyone. So looking forward to picking his brain in a couple minutes. And before we do that, I'll give you just a couple of my initial thoughts on the first week of free agency. But first, I want to refamiliarize you with our great sponsor, Loot Crate. On a quest for epic gear, housewares, and collectibles, Loot Crate offers an epic range of pop culture items for less than $20 a month. Whether you're shopping for the geek in your life or if you are that geek, Loot Crate is the best surprise you know is coming. Every month there's a different theme and new exclusive items you can only get with Loot Crate. Treat yourself every month or give the gift of geeking out to a friend or loved one. Roar. That in the distance, that roar is a call. Will you answer it? This month we're going primal and unleashing the beasts of some of pop culture's most ferocious franchises. This savagely sweet collection has items from Overwatch, Wolverine, Jurassic World, and Predator, and includes, as always, our monthly tee and pin. You have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate, and when the cutoff happens, that's it, it's over. Make sure to head to www.lootcrate.com/Shaw and enter the code Shaw, S-H-A-W, to save $3 off any new subscription today. Alrighty, thank you once again to Loot Crate, and our team's finding savings in free agency. That's kind of how I like to assess, you know, the goings-ons around the league, and I think that some teams have found some potential savings. I really like what the Eagles have done. 1 year after retaining all of their homegrown pieces and collecting quarterbacks and leading the league and spending and handing out guaranteed money by a wide margin, Howie Roseman and the rest of that front office has had to take a lot shrewd, more shrewd approach this season. And I really like what they've ended up with in an Alshon Jeffrey who should be motivated on another one-year deal, this time at a pay cut. You've got Torrey Smith, a field stretcher, to give Carson Wentz a downfield threat and to try and maximize Alshon. They had some nice re-signings, some special teams moves, and Chance Warmack, another guy that they may be able to get really motivated coming off his rookie contract on a one-year deal, who's going to have a chance to compete for that that kind of transitioning offensive line in Philadelphia. So one team that has jumped out to me, I do think they've done well for themselves with the amount of space they've had to work with. On the opposite end of the spectrum, and they're new to this, and I'm not trying to give them a hard time. I'm just calling it like I see it. John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan seem to have a different opinion of a lot of players' value than the rest of the league shares. And everyone's had their fun with the fullback jokes after Kyle Juszczyk's huge deal to come over and get, I believe, $10 million guaranteed to become kind of a core guy for Kyle Shanahan. But it's some of the other deals. Malcolm Smith, former Super Bowl MVP. Pierre Garçon, a really good player, obviously, and he will have a chance to reconnect with the guy, Shanahan, who helped him to his best year in Washington. He led the NFL in catches, actually. But it just seems to me that some of these deals are disproportionate with others being handed out around the league. And I know that San Francisco has a ton of money to spend. That doesn't mean that they are finding the best bargains thus far, at least from my vantage point. On the other end of the spectrum, I guess, the other new GM, Chris Ballard in Indianapolis, impressed with what he's done so far, kind of rebuilding his edges with Jabal Sheard, who no, he did not come cheap. I believe he's going to get about $13 million guaranteed. You send you steal John Simon from your division rival in Houston. Those guys should be day one starters on the edges, and definitely helps the Colts get younger and I think more dynamic and tougher, which is what Chris Ballard said he was setting out to do. So that's been good. I know he needs to get younger, as I just mentioned, and I think he's kind of off on the right foot in that regard. A couple other teams that have jumped out to me: the Jaguars, obviously spending a ton. It's the third straight, at least third straight offseason where they are just going to go wild in free agency and hope for better results than the last 2 years. Obviously, it's Tom Coughlin overseeing this big splurge. You know, the splurge with Shad Khan's checkbook. And I just think A.J. Boye is a great fit there across from Jalen Ramsey. I think Calais Campbell, yes, he's going to be 31, but boy, did he have a big year in Arizona. And when I think about pairing Calais Campbell and Malik Jackson, just two mountains on the inside, that's how you create mismatches while you're still looking for that game changer off the edge. And I do like the kid out of Maryland last year, Yannick Ngakoue. I don't know if I got that right or not. If I didn't, I apologize. But, you know, Dante Fowler, jury's still out. And they're still looking for that guy on the edge. So in the meantime, man, are they going to have a chance to create some opportunities with that inside juice? You add Sheldon Day into that mix as well. Avery Jones, that they've got a lot of horses up front. And I didn't mention Barry Church on the back end across from Tayshawn Gibson, and a pretty good looking secondary that they're putting together in Jacksonville. Remember, this was a very competitive defense last year. They need the offense to take the next step, of course. So it just seems like these are Tom Coughlin type of guys that are going to instill the right kind of toughness and maybe help Jacksonville get over the hump. But of course, ultimately, that's going to come down to the quarterback position. And I don't know what to expect. You'd have to think Blake Bortles is going to get one more shot, but there is no loyalty from Tom Coughlin or Doug Marrone, of course, the interim coach who had that tag taken off, even though he did oversee Marrone, that is, I believe, Bortles' best stretch in year three at the end of last season. So anyway, another team that jumped out at me, the Cleveland Browns, of course, probably the biggest newsmakers on the first day of free agency last week with that NBA-style salary dump that they took on of Brock Osweiler from Houston, along with the second-round pick, of course. Essentially paid if you offset RG3, the money they saved there, I think they paid around $10 million for that second rounder. I know it was a $16 million cap hit that Osweiler carries, and I also know the Browns have no intention of playing Brock Osweiler. Right now, you'd have to think Cody Kessler is the favorite to be the week one starter there, but Cleveland's going to be active, whether it is that extra ammunition they picked up from Houston that turns into Jimmy Garoppolo, whether it's Watson or Trubisky or whoever they grab, maybe at number 12, because I believe Myles Garrett is a shoe-in to be the top pick, whether it's Cleveland or whether they trade down again. But it's fun to watch them build. And then even before Cleveland and Sashi Brown and Hugh Jackson made all the news with that unorthodox trade, which I thought was frankly brilliant. If you have the money to spend and not the players in free agency you're looking to spend it on, they've already shown us how much they value these draft picks, and now they've put a tangible dollar amount on it, apparently. So that was fun. Even before they did that, of course, though, they do make their one big splash signing with Kevin Zeitler, stealing them from their Ohio rivals in Cincinnati. Also re-upping Joel Bitonio, getting to him early, and we'll talk with Joel Corey about the benefits of getting to players early, how that can benefit teams. So it's interesting to watch them put this firm commitment into their offensive line, and I think that if you've struck out 27 times over the past however many years at quarterback, Why not get that line in place first and then make sure once you spend very dearly once again and you got Hugh Jackson overseeing the pick, once you get that guy in, you've already got some of his nice pieces in place. Kenny Britt, you know, a solid player. I didn't quite understand swapping out Kenny Britt for Terrell Pryor. That's kind of the one, sour taste in my mouth on Cleveland's new year so far, is not managing to keep Terrell Pryor when I believe he only agreed to a one-year deal that maxes out at like $7 or $8 million in Washington. I thought it would have really helped them to keep Pryor and pair him with both Kenny Britt and Corey Coleman, the first rounder last year, but obviously they saw it differently. So a few other teams quickly before we chat with Joel Corey. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Patriots and what they have accomplished. It's truly been remarkable. After they give Stephon Gilmore this record cornerback contract to go out and find all these guys via trade, Dwayne Allen and Coney Ealy and Brandon Cooks and I'm forgetting one as well. I know they signed Rex Burkhead as well, but there's another player that they traded for, and hopefully that will come to me here in a moment. But to see Belichick going out and getting these guys that are, you know, they've already all done a lot in the NFL, but arguably all have not even yet reached their prime. It's just the aggression that Belichick has shown going and getting Brandon Cooks for the 32nd overall pick. And it's amazing. After coming off his fifth Super Bowl with the Patriots, he's as aggressive as ever. And it's the reason why I believe that Jimmy Garoppolo absolutely can be had for the right cost this offseason. Now, what the right cost is, I think, is still debatable, but it's clearly going to be a first rounder and probably at least a second rounder, if not a pair of first rounders, a future second rounder as well. So pretty impressive stuff from the Patriots. On the Saints side, it's very fluid because Malcolm Butler reportedly will be in New Orleans. The Patriots restricted free agent and former Super Bowl hero cornerback will be in New Orleans discussing a potential new deal on Thursday. So my initial reaction to the Cook Saints trade was, oh man, they had to get Malcolm Butler. Drew Brees' window not open too long. You need a proven difference maker. You don't have to worry about developing. Now it sounds like maybe the Saints are going to still end up with Butler. So we'll see what happens there. And I will kind of hold off on my judgment of their end of that deal. So I guess that about does it. Just a few other teams. The Lions have been fascinating rebuilding there. Offensive line in advance of giving Matthew Stafford what's expected to be a record deal. I really like bringing in Ricky Wagner, and as much as Wagner made as a right tackle, and we'll talk about that with Joel Corey too, you could argue that maybe the Lions got good value there after you watch what Matt Khalil and Riley Reiff got to go try and play left tackle anyway, because I think the difference is getting blurrier and blurrier between those two spots. Yes, they had to spend to get TJ Lang, the hometown guy, to come home, but they worsened their division rival in the process. Green Bay, I don't know what they're doing at guard, although it's clear what they're doing with a pair of tight ends and Lance Kendricks and Martellus Bennett, maybe getting away from that three wide out personnel grouping a little bit more and going with two tight ends this year is what I would expect. So those are just a few more of the teams that jumped out at me. And one last one, I'm sorry. Is the Cincinnati Bengals. To me, they are now officially closer to rebuilding than returning to the playoffs for what it'd be the sixth time in 7 years. You lose Kevin Zietler, you lose Andrew Whitworth, you lose Burkhead, as we just mentioned. There have been a couple other smaller name guys. Pico, I believe, is on the way out, and Marcus Hunt. And I believe actually it was just today that Carlos Dunlap said, I thought I saw a headline that he doesn't understand what the plan is there. And I'm not sure that I do either, because if the Bengals are in fact bracing for another rebuild, all due respect to Marvin Lewis, the second longest tenured head coach in the NFL and what he did to bring that franchise back to respectability. But he never did get over that that hump and actually win a playoff game. So now does he get to oversee another rebuild? And as all of his former disciples, whether it's Adam Gase or Vance Joseph or Mike Zimmer, have all gone on to early success as head guys, I don't know if the Bengals maybe missed an opportunity to make a move there. And the one guy they did re-sign, Drake Kirkpatrick, to huge money, There's going to be a ton of corners in the draft, but there's not going to be a lot of offensive linemen. So I kind of wonder about the way they prioritize and if they're setting up Andy Dalton for success or ultimately to fail with too many moving parts around him. So not a good look in my view from the Bengals, and to a lesser extent, the Packers losing guys like TJ Lang and Micah Hyde and Dayton Jones. Now they were able to bring back Nick Perry and then stun everyone with the Martellus Bennett signing, but a ton of turnover. J.C. Tretter as well. A lot of key guys leaving Green Bay, and a lot of holes that maybe weren't there before that now Ted Thompson is going to have to plug. So, all right, that's enough of my kind of just freeform blabbering about the first wave of free agency. And just make sure you keep it locked into ProFootballWeekly.com. Check out our top 100 tracker for all the analysis. And now I'm going to bring on someone who actually knows what they're talking about. That's enough from me. Joel Corey, as I mentioned, of CBS Sports and National Football Post, nice enough to take out some time on Wednesday morning and chat about what he's seeing as the biggest takeaways in the first week of free agency. So happy to be joined now on the Pro Football Weekly podcast by Joel Corey. You know his work at CBS Sports, National Football Post. Joel, of course, a former sports agent, breaking down all the salary cap structuring and contract trends that seem to maybe pique even the casual NFL fans' interest even more this time of year. Joel, how you doing? Thanks for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I am doing well, and yeah, we're thrilled to have you on. This time of the year, your expertise is needed as much as ever, so we'll kind of just jump right into what's been a crazy first week of the new league year. And in case you're not already following Joel on Twitter, make sure you're doing so. He's an awesome follow over there, at Corey Joel, CorryJoel, excuse me. And so just very generally, Joel, what kind of jumps out at you at what you've seen so far? I know there have been some crazy contracts by position, and some teams certainly lot more frugal than others, but what's kind of your biggest takeaway as we enter the first week of the new league year being open?
Oh, a couple of things jump out at me. That one, it starts in the trenches, that we've seen teams really pay offensive linemen, not necessarily elite offensive linemen, and it's the wrong year to be a ball carrier. It's a deep year in the draft. Last year you had running backs get money early in Doug Martin, Chris Ivory, and Lamar Miller. This year, it's tough sledding. Eddie Lacy just took a one-year deal to go to Seattle. Right. Jamal Charles, Latavius Murray, Adrian Peterson still on the open market.
Now, do you think with the running backs, and everyone knows that you know, if you're raising your child to play football, running back is probably not the position you're going to choose, but do you think it's a little more case-by-case type situation? Because for me, if Eddie Lacy doesn't have the weight issue, and if he's not coming off the injury, don't you think he may be a multi-year candidate? I feel like he kind of just had too many red flags or too many concerns that ultimately Seattle had to try and wade through.
Yeah, he would have been a multi-year candidate, but he still would have been a buyer beware proposition, because sure, you don't want your running backs to weigh potentially more than any linebacker you have on the team. One of the problems with the running back position is it's an incredibly shrinking market. Adrian Peterson was a $14 million per year back when he signed his deal in 2011. Chris Johnson got in at the 13.5 neighborhood. You don't have any $10 million per year backs now. Marshawn Lynch retired after signing extension for $12 million a year. But now the top of the market is $8 million, and that is LeSean McCoy. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Le'Veon Bell, who I think was given a gift with a $12 million franchise tag, because it would have been interesting to see how he would have been valued in the open market, because he's one of the, I'd say, five best offensive playmakers in football because of his dual threat ability as a running back and a receiver. But would some team go overboard and pay him in the open market if he'd gotten there? We'll never know.
Right. Yeah, that will be fascinating. And certainly Pittsburgh showed how much he matters just by slapping that franchise tag on him. Spending some time with Joel Corey here of CBS. And you led with the offensive linemen and how the guys in the trenches are getting paid, not just
left tackles anymore. We've seen some right tackle, significant right tackle money. Ricky Wagner setting the market. The guards are really getting paid, Joel. Are you surprised? Well, A, I want to ask you what you think about right tackles versus left tackles in the NFL, and if you think that that gap is going to shrink sooner than later, because they're being asked to do a lot of the same things now, but the salaries certainly don't reflect that still.
Yeah, the gap should have started shrinking a long time ago, because it's not the game that it was in Lawrence Taylor's day, where you had the best pass rusher lineup and he's going up against the left tackle almost exclusively. You have guys move around like chess pieces as pass rushers. Von Miller got his Super Bowl 50 MVP going up against a right tackle, Mike Remmers. So it's long overdue for a pure right tackle to get over $7 million per year. Wagner's at $9.5 million a year. I don't call Lane Johnson, who averages about $11.25 a year, as a pure right tackle, because that deal was done with the anticipation he's eventually going to move and replace Jason Peters as Philadelphia's left tackle.
Right.
So it's good to see one of these guys finally break that barrier, and Ricky Wagner, hopefully we'll see more. But what this underscores is the great deal Atlanta got for Ryan Schreiber, because that deal averages not more than $6 million a year, and he's been one of the most consistent right tackles in football. He did it in November around Thanksgiving. I suspect if he had waited and hit the open market, Atlanta was going to be paying a whole lot more to keep him, or he was going to be playing somewhere else on a significantly greater contract.
Yeah, Joel, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's a good segue. You and I have kind of mentioned this on Twitter and have been in agreement. It's a bit of a wonder that more teams don't try and get to their guys early like the Falcons did with Ryan Schrader, certainly like the Bears did with Kyle Long last offseason. There's no doubt in my mind when you look at a guy like TJ Lang getting paid. He's about 2 or 3 years older and got more guaranteed money than Long, who's already played tackle and guard. So I guess two-parter. A, why aren't all teams bent on trying to get to these guys early? And B, as a former agent, put your agent hat on, and I'm guessing you're a little conflicted there when trying to represent your clients and offer advice on what they're supposed to do in that situation.
Actually, some of the more proactive teams or enlightened teams have always tried to get extensions with their young core players before the rookie contracts expire. Mm-hmm. And the one guy that I think that spearheaded that the most, who's no longer a football executive, is Joe Banner. He did that with the Eagles 15, 20 years ago. So I think that's where it started, and more teams need to take a look at that and do it. And Philadelphia went back to that when Howie Roseman took over, got his power back from Chip Kelly, because they extended everyone under the sun last year. Lane Johnson, Zach Ertz, they got Fletcher Cox done.
Yep.
Malcolm Jenkins got an extension. So they really didn't have a whole lot to do in free agency, because they did that. And I think Kansas City made a great preemptive strike this year with Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, because that deal came out of nowhere right after they did Eric Berry, or right around the same time, and it's like, why are they doing him? But they got him done on an extension which averages right about $8 million a year. So if you had to wait until this whole market developed, and they tried to do that thing in July, and then it would have been tough to get any type of deal like that when Ron Leary's getting $9 million a year, Leonard Wolford's $8.5 million. So that was a great preemptive strike. Now, as an agent, it's a balance, because if you got a guy who's on a rookie contract, who's never really been paid, my philosophy was, if I can get about 90% of what I wanted with a favorable structure, and I don't have to forego the risk of injury and poor performance, then it was something that I would recommend my client do. And hopefully in the last year, I'm not going to commit too long, I don't want to give up more than 4 new years in this instance, and hopefully in the last year, either have a mechanism to void with outstanding performance, or some sort of escalator where the salary increases if the guy's playing at an extremely high level. And those two mechanisms would be there to try to prevent any changing market conditions where my client's deal becomes outdated. But the sooner you do a deal, the harder it is for it to keep pace in the market. Because I'll give you the prime example of this. If J.J. Watt can come back from his back injury and he's close to what he was before, not what he was, which is the second coming of Reggie White, practically.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest steal. That's the biggest steal in the NFL because it's $100 million over 6 years. It's under $17 million a year, and he's under contract through, I think, 2021. So that deal will be the best bargain in the NFL over time because I didn't expect Ndamukong Suh to beat it by so much when he was an unrestricted free agent.
Right.
And the market's only gone up since then for the top of the non-quarterback market. And you're going to see if Aaron Donald doesn't do it, then Khalil Mack's going to be the first $20 million per year non-quarterback. And then Houston's going to have another problem. If J.J. Watt is still the best defensive player on the team and Jadeveon Clowney's just scratching the surface of his talent, how are you going to pay Jadeveon Clowney more than J.J. Watt, but his peers are going to be making close to $20 million a year, so you're probably going to have to do Clowney and then renegotiate Watt or you're going to have a major problem on your hands.
Yeah.
But that's what happens when you do a deal early. You do a deal early, you can get it for a very good to great player, you get favorable cap treatment, and you get him at a discounted rate.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think Tyron Smith probably belongs in this conversation too. The Cowboys now reaping the benefits of doing that deal so long and such a long one as well. But Joel, it's interesting you mentioned Houston because I think that was the exception to Rick Smith's rule with J.J. Watt, was it not? Because they weren't willing to negotiate with DeAndre Hopkins last year. And he's another one who kind of comes to mind when you look at what guys like Doug Baldwin or Keenan Allen or Emmanuel Sanders and all those guys took. And even after DeAndre Hopkins didn't have his best season, how does that situation play out, maybe in light of what's going on with the other wide receivers? I mean, I know they don't necessarily belong in the same conversation, but surprised that guys like Alshon and Terrell Pryor found such tough sledding out there on the market.
Yeah, they did. Whitney Mercilus. Right around the same time they had to pick up the option. I'm
okay.
Assuming they didn't pick up the option and did the deal because they knew they were getting it done. So I don't know if JJ's the exception, the trend, or what, but if I'm Hopkins and his agent, my whole thing is we're throwing 2016 out the window because I had a garbage quarterback that I never got on the same page with. So that is an anomaly.
Yeah.
What happened in 2015 and 2014, that's who you're paying for. Now, that may be a tough argument, but also the fact that the receiver market hasn't really advanced since you had Demaryius Thomas, Dez Bryant, A.J. Green, Julio Jones do those deals. You had one guy, Antonio Brown, take it to a new level, but I don't see how Hopkins is going to be able to leapfrog all those guys
mm-hmm.
and get close to Antonio Brown based on what he did in 2016, because as much as the team wants to have him there long term, they're not going to ignore 2016. The agent can keep saying it's an anomaly, but that's going to be something that is going to be central to that negotiation. But the receiver market was interesting from the standpoint that I had heard there was one deal that was supposed to throw a monkey wrench into the whole receiver market, and teams ended up winning and dismissing it. And that was something the Rams did, which was very mind-boggling to me. First, they picked up Tavon Austin's option. He's a first-round pick in 2014 for about $12.3 million. And they compounded the error by giving him an extension, four-year
right.
extension, averaging about $10.5 million a year with $28.5 million in guarantees.
Yep.
Why on earth would you do that for a guy who rarely gets 500 receiving yards? I know he's supposed to be some sort of dual threat where you can use him as a returner, and also he can pick up some rushing yards and sweeps and so forth, but he's a poor man's Percy Harvin. So the fact that teams were able to get most of these guys, with the exception of maybe DeSean Jackson, to come in under that deal, I think that's a big win for teams with the receiver market, because you take that one deal out of the equation and the market came in about where it should. It would have been, which is an increase over Marvin Jones last year, kind of set the top of the number two receiver market at about $8 million per year.
Okay.
But that Tavon Austin deal was the one which agents were trying to use to get better deals for the clients, but for the most part couldn't.
I understand that it's case by case situation, but it also seems to me the Rams have struggled with value in some certain other areas. To be dangling Trumaine Johnson now after he used the tag a second year in a row and he doesn't replicate that awesome season he had in 2015, I mean, again, I know there's been a coaching change, and now it might be Wade Phillips driven, but it's hard to argue that Tremaine Johnson's value is as good now as it may have been last season, I'm thinking.
No, he didn't have the type of year in 2016 that he had in 2015. But they had a problem in that whole negotiation. The second they chose him for the tag over Janoris Jenkins, whatever Janoris Jenkins got was going to be what he viewed as his floor. And if you weren't going to pay that, sure, then you probably should have tried to move him last year as opposed to this year.
Yep.
Because sticking a tag on him a second time for almost $17 million, he has the luxury of being able to get paid an insane amount of money to go out and have another prove-it season and bounce back. But we also saw at the same time that a cornerback who had an inconsistent season, Stephon Gilmore, was able to get a contract at the same level as A.J. Bouye, but with more overall guarantees. So maybe because corners are a commodity, that it won't necessarily hurt Johnson as much if they can find a way to do a tag and trade.
Okay. Yeah, you know, good situation for Johnson that he's sitting in right now. Obviously, same can be said for Kirk Cousins. You know, despite all the dysfunction swirling in Washington, just the likelihood that he may now play on that one-year tag 2 years in a row and pocket whatever it is, $44-45 million, and then still have a chance to hit the market in a long-term deal is pretty amazing. Joel, we'll try and hit on that Cousins issue, but let me ask you, we're chatting with Joel Corey of CBS Sports. Hit him up on Twitter, at Corey Joel, CORRYJOEL. Joel, can you take the listeners through what options the Patriots and the Saints have in this Malcolm Butler dance? You kind of reminded me of the Patriots with the Stephon Gilmore deal. But kind of for the novice listeners, even for me, actually, I don't understand how he can have the RFA tag and now suddenly they may be able to do a trade that doesn't involve the 11th overall pick. Is that right?
Yeah, well, what happens is that, one, is an RFA, he can shop himself to Malcolm Butler, that is, to other teams through the restricted free agent signing period that ends, I think, like the 21st or 22nd of April, about a week before the draft.
Okay.
And if he signs an offer sheet with that team, since they gave him a first-round tender, presumably the Saints, then they'd have to give up their first-round pick if the offer sheet wasn't matched. Now, what sometimes happens, and it's happened with franchise tag players before, because the franchise tag player that's a non-exclusive guy, it's two first-round picks for an unmatched offer sheet. What sometimes happens is the player will talk to the team, and this was happening with Chris Ivory a couple of years ago when he went to the Jets. He visited the Jets as a Saints RFA.
Mm-hmm.
He had a second-round tender on him, and he didn't sign an offer sheet. Then the Jets and the Saints started talking about compensation, which was less than the RFA offer sheet compensation of a second-round pick, and worked out a trade. Now, what the player has to do in that situation is also sign the tender, or he can't be traded.
Mm-hmm.
But the scenario would be something like this, that he's visiting the Saints, they're talking a contract, New England and the Saints will start talking about what the compensation would be, which would be less than the 11th overall pick. They'd agree on that. He'd sign the tender, get traded, sign the contract with the Saints, and New England gets their draft picks. They did that a few years ago, maybe about 10 years ago now, with Wes Welker in Miami, because Miami put a low tender on him. They brought him in for a visit. Instead of signing to an offer sheet, they worked out a trade of Miami as well. So it's something that's been done in the past in lieu of the offer sheet. So it would not surprise me if that's the method in which that went down.
Okay. Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with Malcolm Butler. Now, of course, the Saints and Patriots already pulled off the trade that sent Brandon Cooks to New England in exchange for the 32nd overall pick. So perhaps that's a part of a potential deal moving forward as well. Joel, the other one, I'm hoping you can explain to the listeners kind of in lay terms, what's the deal with having to spend to the salary cap floor? I know some of these teams, 49ers fans, Browns fans, probably wondering with all the money their team still has and not enough players to go out there and spend it on. How exactly does that work to make sure they're within league protocol getting to the spending floor?
There is no annual spending floor like in the NBA. The spending minimums apply over a four-year period,
okay,
2013 to 2016, and 2017 to 2020. So the Niners and Browns, with their almost $100 million of cap room, could have sat out free agency, had a bare bones payroll, and it would have been fine. Fan bases mm-hmm. would have revolted, but from a CBA salary cap standpoint, they could have done that. They could have done it again in 2018, spent like drunken sailors in 2019 and 20, and hit the 89% spending minimum, which is 89% of the salary cap in cash over the four-year period, and still been fine. I think the union made a mistake in not having a shorter time frame for the spending minimum to apply. At the worst case scenario, it should have been over a two-year period, but really should have been every year. Because mm-hmm. I think that would you couldn't hoard cap room like you do. You wouldn't see Cleveland carrying over $50 million in cap space and having $100 million in cap room if you had an annual spending limit. But it's 89% of the cap in cash each team has to spend over a four-year period. The four-year period just started over again, and it's running 2017 to 2020.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. It'll be interesting because I agree with you wholeheartedly. It should be annually and not every 4 years. I wonder if maybe that would be one of the potential bargaining chips when a new CBA is ready to be discussed. Just a couple more minutes here with Joel, and I do have to ask about what's going on in Dallas too and Tony Romo. If the contract isn't tradable, and I'm guessing you're going to say that's the case, what's going on with Jerry Jones and his son that isn't his actual son, Tony Romo?
I think the first mistake Jerry made was we're going to do right by Tony Romo by saying that publicly. If he hadn't said that, I don't think anyone would really have the same type of scrutiny of what's going on, why is he still on the roster, because you expect Dallas to try to do what's in the best interest of the team. That they're not supposed to make Tony Romo happy. Obviously, they're not going to try to trade Tony Romo to someplace he doesn't want to go. But they have every right to try to get something in return and explore those avenues. Now, if they can't find something by the end of the owner's meeting, I think it's time to cut bait and let him go. Because if you can't get a trade after you're in a place where all the owners are, and we've gone almost a month of free agency, 3 weeks, then you're probably not going to get anything for him. And I never thought they were going to be able to get anything strong for him anyway, because he's old and he's got durability concerns. And don't forget, Brett Favre went for a conditional fourth after an all-pro season, taking the Packers to the NFC Championship. Ultimately, it was a third-round pick. Mm-hmm. So I always thought Tony Romo would get released. It's not on his exact timing, which would have been at the start of free agency. But he should be released by the time the Final Four is over.
Okay, interesting. And then just lastly, on the way out, I'm wondering what's going on with Dante Hightower? Have you been part of negotiations? Reportedly, I believe it was NFL Media said that the Steelers gave him an ultimatum. If he was going to get on the plane, they were pulling an offer that they had for him on Tuesday. Why did Dante Hightower slip into the second or third wave of free agency? And B, is that a normal negotiating tactic? It kind of sounded like a way to maybe lose a guy to me.
Yeah, it's a tactic you use when you suspect you're being used
right.
to get more money out of another team, so you put a clock on the offer. I think the whole problem with Dante Hightower is, and I've said this from day one, the Patriots can have a hard time convincing his representation that he should take less than Jamie Collins, a guy they traded away. So that $12.5 million per year, $26.4 fully guaranteed to Jamie Collins is probably his floor. Now, the best way for New England to get him for under that is for him to have a soft market, which I suspect is the case, or he'd already be signed a long time ago. He'd have signed Thursday or Friday, Tennessee or wherever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but it would not surprise me if the best offer is still New England. He needs something to save face to go back there, because he doesn't want to go back there where they've won the bet in a significant way. So he's trying to get what he can out of everyone else, use them as leverage to make New England pay more. Now, it's because players get emotional, they have pride, so sometimes they go, I'll go any place but there where I was because they've disrespected me, and I think that could be coming into play. Okay. But for him still sitting out there is a little surprising, but New England seems like most of the things they do turn out right, and sometimes I wonder if Bill Belichick is playing chess while the rest of the league is playing checkers.
Yeah, and just because we are on the topic, just very quickly, Joel, do you think Belichick probably doesn't make that deal for Cooks unless he fully plans on giving him a long-term deal, or do you think maybe he's in such aggressive mode he wants that sixth Super Bowl. He'll go, you know, take it day by day and see what Cooks gives to the team first.
I wouldn't be so sure he's going to give him a long-term deal. He has that fifth-year option that they'll exercise, but that's a team that never pays wide receivers. The only one they really paid was Randy Moss, and that kind of blew up because Randy Moss made it a self-fulfilling prophecy that he wanted out because he didn't think they were going to give him a new deal, which they probably weren't. They paid Wes Welker on a franchise tag 1 year. So other than that, they don't pay receivers. They traded Deion Branch as opposed to paying him when he held out about 10, 12 years ago. We had a guy, Troy Brown, they never paid because they viewed him as a Wes Welker, Danny Amendola, Julian Edelman type. Mm-hmm. So that's one position they don't pay. So it would be surprising to me if they're going to end up paying $12, $13, $14 million per year for a receiver. I think he may be a two-year rental.
Okay, interesting. That's Joel Corey from CBS Sports National Football Post. Hit him up on Twitter, at Corey Joel. That was awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We'd love to have you back sometime soon, dropping more knowledge about the NFL salary cap and all the other good stuff, Joel.
Sure, anytime. Thanks for having me.
All right, yeah, it's our pleasure. Once again, Joel Corey, and make sure you find his work at CBS Sports and National Football Post.
All right, that was awesome stuff from Joel Corey. One more big thank you to him. His first time on the PFW podcast, but I promise it won't be his last because I don't know about you, but I learned a ton during that interview and had a really fun discussion. So we'll have Joel back sooner than later. That is going to do it for today's Pro Football Weekly podcast. One more polite reminder to head over to iTunes if you haven't done so already and subscribe to PFW and leave us a rating, a comment, a like. All those forms of interaction are huge help. And I'm your host, Arthur Arkish. Appreciative, as always, that you are with us again this week. One more big thank you to our sponsor, Loot Crate. One more thank you to Joel. And the biggest thank you of all is again, for you guys. And I look forward to being back with you next week. And don't worry, we are going to quickly switch gears. We got 5 weeks left until the draft. We are putting the finishing touches on our Pro Football Weekly Draft Magazine update. Greg Gabriel doing a ton of updated scouting reports. We've got team needs after free agency. We've got features. We've got lots of good stuff from the combine. So you're going to want to get your hands on that. It should be available in just a couple weeks. And like I said, the information is going to be up to the second. And I can't wait to start sharing that with you on the Pro Football Weekly podcast. Thanks again for being with us.